Coming up on this week's episode of Mars Ready Now, the SLS still exists and is predictably over budget. Can nanodiamond batteries solve the world's energy needs while providing a safe solution to nuclear waste disposal? And Soren goes off on a tangent about the history of a small town in Canada you've never heard of. All that and more on this week's episode of Mars Ready Now.
Mars Ready Now is a manifesto. The new space race is real. People are hyped. But the terrible truth is that only a small fraction will ever actually know what it's like to travel beyond Earth. Most of those who wonder will never find out. We do not want to miss out on humanity's greatest adventure. When the call goes out, whenever that may be, we do not want to be unprepared. I'm your host, James Coombs. I'm joined by my good friend, Soren Childs, and this is Mars Ready Now. Hello and welcome to Mars Ready Now, Episode 4, the podcast that asks the question, are you, or me, or any of us, ready to go to space? First up, the news. And this week, we're going to actually make an effort to talk about the news that we alluded to in the intro, because last week, we kind of forgot to do that. It is September the 5th, 2020. And remember, we are not experts analyzing the news. Rather, we are enthusiasts exploring it. So let's start exploring. Soren, go. I choose you.
All right. So, before we started, I opened up space.com to figure out what the headlines were when I was writing that intro section, and I saw something that seemed custom-made for my personal prejudices with the headline, yes. NASA Mega Rocket Blasts Past Cost Estimate, Forces Congress Notification.
Yes, we are all very aware that you hold... that you hold views about government bureaucracy cost abilities to stay within cost for projects, along with lots of other stuff.
Yes. That is an accurate statement about some of my reasons for this prejudice. Yep, however,
definitely. So this news,
for those of you who had forgotten, NASA is still working on a replacement for the space shuttle with their space launch system. They're going back to just straight up rockets, apparently. And it turns out that, let's just start reading off this news story here. NASA's new space launch system, Mega Rocket, and associated ground infrastructure have soared past original cost estimates to a degree that requires the agency to notify Congress about the ballooning budget. The recently appointed leader of NASA's human spaceflight efforts, Kathy... not too sure how to pronounce that. It's L-U-E-D-E-R-S. I want to say Luders, but I'm not sure. Kathy Luders announced the cost... announced the cost estimates in a blog post published August 27th. What is that?
About a week ago.
Last Friday, Thursday. So this news story was actually just posted 4 hours ago on space.com. That will mean that it's probably taken a week just for them to actually go through the paperwork of notifying whatever part of Congress handles these things. The new development baseline costs for the SLS is $9.1 billion, and the commitment for the initial ground system capability to support the rocket's first mission is $2.4 billion, Luders wrote, without elaborating on what the previous baseline costs were. Congress had previously approved $7 billion commitment for the SLS's development, according to 2019 fiscal numbers. The first launch of SLS is scheduled to be Artemis 1, a test flight to send an uncrewed spacecraft around the moon in November of 2021. Mm-hmm. In preparation for a 2024 moon landing, Luders wrote that the Artemis 1 mission remains on track so far, although the agency is cautious due to the potential impact of the coronavirus pandemic that has forced physical distancing and in some cases led to the shortage of parts in the space industry. A successful green run hot fire test will enable us to better predict a target launch date for the mission, she wrote. She also noted that future rocket development should proceed more smoothly and that the Orion spacecraft to carry astronauts remains on track for a test mission to the lunar orbit in November 2023.
This isn't too much longer, so I'll just read to
the end.
Okay.
You were good. Anywhere you want to hop in here, fine, James.
Okay, fine. Well, I was going to say, it really does seem to me that you said that the leader of the space program was recently appointed.
Let's see here. Yeah, a recent appointed leader of NASA's human spaceflight efforts.
Really does seem to me that that is a that seems like the kind of political position that you shove somebody into when you want somebody else to take the blame for something. I'm not entirely sure of the wisdom of accepting that position, since the first thing you have to do is go and stand up and tell Congress, "Yeah, we've gone massively over budget." That does kind of sound like someone else is quietly exiting out of the position just before everything starts falling down so that they don't have a massive failure on their resume.
Yes.
I mean, call me a cynic, please. It's my only form of identity.
Looking at her Wikipedia entry here, Luders began her NASA career in 1992 in the propulsion lab at the White Sands Test Facility as the only the second woman to work in at that facility. Luders started as a depot manager of the Space Shuttle Program Orbital Maneuvering System and Reaction Control Systems. She has also held several managerial positions within the International Space Station Program Office at NASA's Johnston Space Center in Houston, Texas. She also was responsible for NASA's oversight of international partnered spacecraft visiting the space station, including the European Space Agency's automated transfer vehicle, the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency's H-2 transfer vehicle, and the Russian Space Agency's Roscosmos Soyuz and Progress spacecraft. She went to Kennedy as the acting commercial crew program manager in 2013 and was selected as head of that office in 2014. And then nothing for 6 years until suddenly, in June 2020, NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine announced Kathy Luders to the agency's new Associate Administrator of the Human Exploration and Operations Mission Directorate.
Well, I'm sure we wish her all the best and good luck with her new position. I'm sorry?
That is a very recent appointment.
Yeah. Like I said, I'm sure we wish her all the best and hope that she succeeds in wrangling some control to the SLS program. Because, you know, I mean, I'm sure you will hold a different opinion. I am of the opinion that as many systems that can put things in orbit as possible is good, even if one of them is a massively over budget and bloated government program. That won't stop SpaceX or Blue Origin or Rocket Lab or any of these other chaps. So. More stuff in space. Well, I say it won't stop Blue Origin, you know. I mean, Blue Origin, Yeah, I want to go on and start ragging on Blue Origin again. Blue Origin at this point feels like they could be stopped by a paperclip. No. I shouldn't do that. Bad James.
Well,
but it does segue us nicely into SpaceX.
Yeah, ragging on
because
Blue Origin,
SpaceX,
my job.
Oh, your job. Okay. Well, now you can rag on the government. I'll rag on Blue Origin. There is sort of a distribution of responsibility. Fair enough?
I'm thinking you might have to find something else to rag on here because
ragging on Blue Origin, okay.
And the government.
Okay, well, nevertheless, it does feel like SpaceX isn't going to be stopped by anything short of a huge bulldozer or something, because last week SpaceX had 3 launches, which is, I mean, the fact that we are currently living in a time where a company launches 3 different things in 1 week.
Operation.
Yeah. I mean, this is just like the mind is blowing up. If you'd said, I need to slow down, sorry. If you had said 3 years ago or 4 years ago that a private company, SpaceX, would be launching 3 launches a week. Now, granted, it's not continual launches. You know, we're not seeing a continual launch cadence of 3 launches a week. But nevertheless, the fact that we are launching 3 things in 1 week is nuts compared to the standard state of affairs as they existed 5 to 10 years ago. So for those of you who, allow me to read them. SpaceX launches the first polar orbit mission from Florida in decades on a downwards trajectory to the South Pole via Cuba. And that, I believe, is the first time that any spacecraft has left U.S. soil on that particular trajectory for a very long time, because I think it was 1969, if I recall correctly, that was the last time that particular polar orbit trajectory from that launch facility was used. From Cape Canaveral, the reason being that the last time they used that launch trajectory, a booster rocket fell down and killed a cow in Cuba. And this was in 1969, so it caused a bit of an international incident. Fidel Castro spoke off on radio and TV, decrying America for murdering cows and various other silliness. In reality, I suspect that the reason why the United States decided to stop using that trajectory
is famous for cats is hardly surprising.
I think that in reality, the reason why the United States stopped using that trajectory was because they didn't want Cuba taking too close a look at their rocket technology that was dropping on Cuba. So I suspect that was more to the point. But nevertheless, it has been a very long time since that particular trajectory has been used. SpaceX launched it, and they were successful. Let's have a look at the other one. And that was on August 31st, so about 6 days ago. Then, on September the 3rd, so 2 days ago, SpaceX launches another 60 Starlink satellites. It's almost not even news these days. They did not catch the fairings this time, but they did manage another perfect landing on the drone ships. Of course, on the drone ship, Of Course I Still Love You, of the booster, which was the second time that particular booster had landed. So the third time that it was... No, that is completely incorrect, James. It was the second time it landed, and it was the second time it went up. There we go. Math, James. Math, or maths, I should say, because I'm British. And SpaceX also did a new hop. Ta-da! SN6. SN6 blasted off in a carbon copy launch of the 150-meter hop of SN5, for those of you who are not 100% familiar with what we are talking about. This is the Starship program that SpaceX currently has undergoing. There, SpaceX's attempt to build a fully reusable orbital rocket.
Not to worry about.
Sorry, can you say that again?
I said, this is you versus the grain silo she tells you not to worry about.
Yes, that we have seen the memes about this particular rocket because it has no nose and it has no fins. So it's just a big cylindrical
steel
cylinder, yeah, with a bit of weight on the top. And it does look very much like a grain silo. This joke has been going around for a very long time now. I can't say I disapprove of it because it does look very much like that. The stand did not explode, which is nice, because the last time they sent up SN5 for a 150-meter test hop with one of the new Raptor engines, the stand kind of exploded a bit when they lifted off. This time, it did not explode, which was very nice. I approve of that, although it did catch on fire a little bit when it landed. I believe that Elon, Mr. Musk, would like to massively increase the cadence for Starship testing. I've heard some people suggest that we will see a 20-kilometer hop by a full Starship prototype by the end of the year. But we also know, because of the brilliant detective work that is done by people like Las Padre and Mary, Boca Chica girl, that the chaps at SpaceX in Boca Chica are starting to work on the heavy boosters, because Starship is in two parts. It has the Starship, which is the bit on top, which is the bit that actually goes to Mars. And then there's the heavy booster on the top bottom, which is massive. I mean, we're talking 29 Raptor engines, and the Raptor engine is the most efficient engine that we've ever seen now. So it's kind of nuts. Yeah. Yeah, I know.
You know, James.
I feel much the same way.
You know, James, just because I need to get in my quota for today, when you said that Elon Senpai was thinking that he'd like to increase the cadence of his rocket launches, It got me thinking, when was the last time Blue Origin launched a rocket? Without looking it up, can you tell me?
Was it 2014?
You are incorrect. Blue Origin did in fact launch a rocket in December of 2019.
Oh.
It was a suborbital flight.
Well, of course it was. How far up was it? Did they get past the Kármán line?
You're going to need to remind me how high
100 kilometers.
Oh.
The official definition of space.
Of the Kármán line.
It was how far?
4.5 kilometers above the Kármán line.
Okay, so they went straight up. They got a little bit over the Kármán line. They said, right, we're done. Good. And they returned back to Earth. I would like to point out that a few kilometers above the Kármán line is basically what Bert Rutan pulled off in 2004 when he won the Ansari X Prize. And he did it with a person on board as well. Now, I'm fully aware that what Blue Origin is attempting to do is not in any way the same thing that what Bert Rutan and Scaled Composites were doing in the early 2000s. Blue Origin is attempting to build out the infrastructure and the technology for something far grander than what Scaled Composites was doing. And also, to be fair, the child company of Scaled Composites, the spaceship company, and Virgin Galactic haven't exactly gone much further than that either. So, I mean, they have. They now have paid customers who are going up for suborbital jaunts of their own. But that doesn't change the fact that Blue Origin is still suborbital. SpaceX is orbital. Rocket Labs is orbital. And we'll have to see. Technically, Virgin Galactic's brother company. I don't know what to call it. They have another company as well that deals with small sats. They also get put into orbit. So technically Virgin Galactic do Orbital as well. So we'll add them to the list as well. But not Blue Origin. Yeah. So what else is going on? You've got the news open. I think we've got time for one or two more pieces. Yes.
The news. Let's see here. We're talking a lot about, well, I say a lot. We've got two separate stories about a Netflix series. Come on, people. This is space news.
What's the news? Yeah, is it like a recording series done in space? Mars,
but still.
Okay. Well,
no, it's a series about a Mars mission.
Oh, hang on. Here's something interesting. Oh, no, sorry. That was too long ago. I can't use that news story. That was from August 25th. Slapped down. Yeah, interestingly enough, it seems that most of the news around space this week seems to be simply a lot of launches. There's nothing really that interesting. Like, Ariane Space delayed the launch for a Vega rocket. So that's a launch that didn't happen. Elon Musk offers update on SpaceX's Starship Mega Rocket, which is an update. Hang on, let me just read this and see what the update actually is. I don't believe there is anything. I'm sure I would have heard if he was announcing anything absolutely mind-blowing. But while I'm reading this, have you found anything interesting? He's not really saying
I haven't, but if you would permit me a brief unscheduled tangent.
Sure.
It was just occurring to me that with this new high watermark of three SpaceX launches in 1 week, the thing that sprang to mind with that number of rockets in the air was Doc Smith's science fiction writing from back in the 1930s and 1940s, and particularly his, I guess it was kind of an anthology of short stories called Triplanetary, which was retroactively grafted onto the underbelly of the Lensman series as a prequel. But in Triplanetary, Doc Smith, who lived through both world wars, I think, and was involved in munitions manufacturing during the Second World War, and part of Triplanetary was an autobiographical section of that. But Doc Smith, who lived at that time, believed that I don't want to say he actually believed it. I don't know for sure. But he wrote fiction about the possibility of the Cold War becoming hot. And he expected not the intercontinental ballistic missile setups that we actually got during the Cold War, but that there would be crewed rockets streaking through the air at suborbital altitudes, firing missiles at each other. From rockets. It was
wow,
a little wacky, to be certain. But it just...
Yeah, well, having
this many rockets in the air during a single week, that's what came to mind for me. This vision of not merely three rockets, but hundreds of rockets streaking through the air on some purposeful mission. I'm very happy to report from our lofty vantage point in the year 2020 that we have managed to avoid nuclear holocaust thus far.
Yes.
On the day that we say... And I hope that on the day that we say 100 rocket launches in a single week, it will be because Elon Musk is sending an entire flotilla to Mars, as opposed to sending hundreds of men and women to their unsightly deaths in, you know, one of those things that only governments do. Wars.
We shouldn't get into a debate about this.
At a later date, James. Anyways, did you have any more news?
Kind of. I had three things to say to that. The first thing I had to say was that you never saw the movies from the, I don't know, things like the 1940s, 1950s. There's this one particular clip that Isaac Arthur on his YouTube channel likes to show, which is a black and white clip of the image of spaceflight as it was perceived during one of Hollywood's times. I think they were doing some kind of moon sci-fi show, sci-fi movie or something like that. And the means by which these individuals got into space was being put into a cannon and fired from the cannon into space. And this particular, because, you know, it's like, you know, because the idea is that technically it could work, you know, if you can fire something fast enough from a cannon, if you can achieve orbital velocity, then you could go into orbit from a cannon. It just needs to be an incredibly powerful cannon. But the idea that anyone is going to survive that is obviously utterly not in any way the case. But it was amusing. It's amusing to see anyway. The other thing that I have to say is that from this report on Elon Musk gives updates on SpaceX Starship mega rocket program, it has a little bit of note on the fact that they're probably going to reduce the number of Raptor engines from 30 to 28. But this is not because they are reducing payload, more because Raptor is proving to be so unbelievably efficient and so powerful and being able to achieve such high pressures from their constant tinkering that they just don't need as many engines, which is good because it means that they can produce more rockets quicker for a lower price, presumably. And the other little interesting nugget from this is that the NASA Lunar Lander contract with SpaceX, which is valued at $135 million, Musk considers that to be helpful and appreciated, but not actually that important, at least at the moment, to the project, given that he estimates that Starship's total development cost to be more than $5 billion, Mr. Musk says. He does not say whether this $5 billion is money that he has allocated to the program, whether this is money that will be spent in total on the program, or whether this is money that has already been spent on the program. I find it hard to believe that he's burned through $5 billion already. And that's a lot of money. I appreciate that Boca Chica is being built out quite rapidly, but $5 billion is still a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And if he had a burn rate of $5 billion for the program, given the fact that the program has only been up for a year, then that would indicate that he's burning through $5 billion a year, which that can't be the case, can it? That can't be the case.
You're right. I don't think that he could burn through capital at quite that pace, even given everything he's doing.
Yeah, so that's got to be his estimated total budget for the entire program, which, given the fact that Mr. Musk just blasted through the $100 million net worth barrier, like, Tesla is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I don't know how sustainable that rise is or whether the stock price is going to be sustainable, but there is no question whatsoever that if it stays the way it is, Elon, the one advantage that Jeff Bezos had, which is to say that Elon Musk is this tiny little billionaire who's only got like a net worth of like $1.5 to $2 billion or something like that. That was Elon Musk's position, right? And then in a couple of years, it's just gone from, oh, Elon Musk is this tiny small-time billionaire and Jeff Bezos is this titan of the world who owns literally everything, to, oh, Elon Musk also now owns literally everything. Together, they own actually everything.
I had not checked in on this recently, but Musk's net worth is now sitting at $82.4 billion.
Which is absolutely bonkers, because only this time last year, it was, or not even this time last year, it was like in November or something. It was in November. He was sitting pretty at like $15 or $16 billion. And back then I remember thinking, wow, that was an impressive. But it's gone up a lot. And the idea that the Starship program has a total budget of $5 billion. Yeah. Elon Musk, as he is now, he can sneeze out that much, quite frankly. So good. I'm very happy about this, because it just means that, yeah, he can bankroll.
Yes.
He can bankroll.
Much like Doc Smith's vision of the Cold War, I think we're running out of factual material for a basis of analysis, and that if we go much further, it's all going to be speculation.
Excellent segue. Okay. Anyway, yes, this is Speculation Street, the segment where we take one article, project, company, or anything else we might find, and then speculate wildly on what it could mean for the near-term future of humans in space. And this week's target is... I need a run-up for this one. This week's target is NDB, the company that wants to stuff nuclear waste into your phone. I'm not entirely sure how much investigation we need to do. I kind of just sort of gave the...
Thank you for thinking that my transition was smooth. I was going to criticize myself for being ham-fisted, but yes... NDB, Nano Diamond Battery. The people who want to take irradiated carbon control rods, a very common form of nuclear waste product, and use them to create diamonds that are going to be throwing off electrons. And according to the video on the company's website, they're planning to make these in consumer electronics sizes.
Just the thing that most
for your phone, James. Also, double A, triple A.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that? A Tickle Me Elmo.
I've got a nuclear powered wristwatch.
Battery.
Yeah, I like the idea. I like the idea of having a nuclear powered wristwatch, because it's got like, you know, one of those tiny little batteries in. Yeah, it's just all sorts of fun. I really like their marketing. Like, they have a smartphone that doesn't require charging, and then on the front it's got 100% discharging, estimated time remaining on the battery, 9 years. And then they have a car, which is estimated charge remaining, 90 years.
You realize what this is, James. This is
go on. Well, no.
This is the culmination of every sci-fi geek's dreams. We finally have the potential for energy crystals.
Oh, God. Yeah, you're right, aren't you? Could have like a staff with one of these massive diamonds on the end. I didn't know, but you could. You could have like a staff with a massive diamond. I don't know what the diamonds are actually going to look like. I don't know what the mechanism by which the diamonds are actually going to look, whether or not you could actually take the diamond that they make and cut it like you would a piece of jewelry, so that you could have one of these things. But you could I really like the idea of having like a ring with a diamond set into it that is producing electricity, and then like a small wire that's coming from your ring that you then use to power something, because it's like, this is my power ring. They also want to put these in medical devices that you put into your body.
So that it glows.
They also want to put these in medical devices that they install into people, because that's a big problem with medical devices, right? Powering them. You don't want to have a medical device that runs out of battery.
Obviously.
Yeah. So figuring out how to power medical devices that are into the human body is a big challenge. But nevertheless, yeah, this could be a solution to that. I think one of the things that I found most interesting about this is the media's response to it. I basically fell into line with it because it is by far the most memeable part of this whole thing. Basically, every single media company has taken the nuclear waste part and they've run with it. So they've, you know. But on the other hand, I haven't seen a lot of scaremongering, which is very interesting. Most of the news articles that I've read about NDB are taking the "this is a solution to nuclear waste" angle rather than the "should we be concerned about the fact that a company wants to take batteries and make them nuclear powered? You know, is this the right thing to do? Is this ethical? Is this good?" No, most people seem to be taking the "this is good for the environment and this is good for people" approach to it, which I find to be moderately encouraging. I'm sure that there will be people who will criticize it at some point, but I'm totally for it. And since we're on Speculation Street, I'm now going to speculate because that's kind of the point of this thing, right? Here's my speculation.
Well, we do have
Sorry.
Concrete piece of evidence that I would like to introduce into the discussion before we take off on a wild tangent. And it's that on the front page of this website, ndb.technology, it does say, "to reinvent electricity and create a planet without fossil fuels by 2040. So I don't know what exactly their timetable is, but they do say that they're shooting for this technology over the next 20 years. So
here's the thing.
Be sure
to create a planet
your expectations accordingly. Unless, of course, Elon Musk buys the company.
I'm not entirely sure about that particular timeline. I think it's a nice idea. The only way that I can think that they would be able to create a planet without fossil fuels by 2040 based on this technology is to, well, basically what they're doing, and this kind of leads into my own speculation, at least one piece of my speculation, is that they are taking a waste product, which is one of the main reasons why people don't like nuclear power, and turning it into a profitable product, which not only is a thing which can be used as a sort of buy-the-buy product, but which is actually categorically superior to literally everything that's currently on the market. There are probably downsides to it. I don't know what they are. But this battery, if it works, if it has, you know, if it passes muster, if it's safe, etc., then this is going to change everything if this works, if this manages to get onto the market properly. There's only going to be a limited supply. I know that we've had nuclear power plants for a lot, and there is probably a large amount of nuclear waste sitting around in bunkers and so forth that can be opened up, that can be turned into this battery. But at some point, the demand for these batteries, if they prove to be acceptable to the market, is going to exceed the supply of the nuclear power plants is either going to exceed the supply that we have currently lying around, or is going to exceed the supply of the nuclear power plants that are currently in action that are creating the power, at which point there will be an actual economic incentive to create new nuclear power plants, which I'm vaguely in favor of simply because from my understanding of things, and I haven't delve deeply into this, but from my understanding of things, the basic control structures for nuclear power plants haven't been updated in like 30, 40 years. And that's one of the reasons why accidents occasionally still happen, just because we haven't had any new development in that industry in nearly half a century.
Well, I don't think there haven't been any new developments. I seem to recall a video that came out in the not too distant past, like within the past decade, that was looking at relatively small scale modular nuclear power plants. I think you and I discussed that one. Yeah.
Yeah. But here's the thing.
There has been new developments in nuclear
power. Well, they haven't though, because that particular example that you are citing is actually a brilliant example of what I mean, because from what I understand, there were a whole bunch of proposals and companies working on various devices and stuff that were being funded by various agencies, like the one that you just mentioned. Then Fukushima happened, and all the support got withdrawn. Which is like, mwah, mwah, mwah. But here is my speculation. If these chaps succeed in bringing this particular battery to market, if it finds niche applications in various fields, such as the medical industry or in space, because that's another thing that these batteries would be incredibly useful for, or they are just simply categorically superior to the current battery technology we have on the basis that they don't need to be charged and they are allowed into everyday consumer electronics, whether it's phones or whatever, then that creates a kind of normalization of nuclear technology in the minds of the general public. If everyone is running around with batteries that are nuclear batteries that are created from a waste material from nuclear power plants, then suddenly it doesn't seem such a, it doesn't, I suspect it won't seem as politically difficult to create new nuclear power plants. And even now, there are already a large number of interests around the world that are clamoring for new nuclear power plants. It's not a thing that, and we're talking powerful interests as well. And mostly they're just being held back by public perception of nuclear technology. This is one of those things that could very well bring the idea of nuclear technology as being safe and cool and funky and, you know, and okay to work with again back into the public imagination. That's my speculation. How about you?
You hit a good point with the first and fourth items on that list. I'm not sure I would include funky on my requirements specifications for nuclear power technology.
Fair enough.
But I think you have, by tangential association, identified the biggest risk factor to this, which is, yes, the public perception element. Because, as you will recall, but our audience probably won't, during the Lost episode, I commented that I thought that philosophy was going to have the largest impact on space out of any non-space technology field in the coming decades. And in particular, I think that what I regard as the sorry state of the public's psychoepistemology, that is, their method of knowing things, you are perhaps over-optimistic about the future in this case. And my goodness, I'm sounding more like Mr. Tate, my 12th grade science teacher, every day. But
maybe
at least Mr. Tate was pages us about the benefits of nuclear power. It's just that he despaired of the youth of today, and me in particular, for the fact that we hadn't quite figured out how to know things. For instance, how do we know for certain that the nuclear power is safe? And all it's going to take is one prominent scaremonger to create, the nuclear power equivalent of the Flat Earth Society.
I think you'll find that particular organization already exists and is well at work in the general world. There are a lot of people who are anti-nuclear power for all sorts of reasons. I can't delve into it too deeply myself, simply because, as I said before, I have not gone deep into nuclear power. So I am thoroughly unqualified to give any kind of reasonable opinion on this, other than a vague feeling that perhaps the risks are a bit overblown. But we should probably mention that a lot of this is just speculation. There we go. Okay, and just like that, we move into T-minus Unknown, in which we talk specifically about being Mars ready now. Whether this is something we're doing ourselves to prepare for humanity's future in space, or thoughts we've had about the general principles, so that if and when the time comes, we're not all massively disappointed. And since my own contribution to this particular episode is going to be reasonably minimal, I'm just going to start us off, if you're okay with that, Soren.
Go right ahead.
Cool. Okay. For those of you who aren't aware, for those of you who haven't listened to an episode of Mars Ready Now before, we have a number of fields that we are continually making improvements in. The idea being that when the time comes for volunteers or paid customers or employees to be called up to go to space, that we will actually be in a position to be ready for this. And one of those fields that we are preparing ourselves for is physical exercise, being physically capable, being physically fit, because it's highly likely that high levels of physical endurance and fitness will be required. We know this because of what's been going on in the International Space Station. If you are massively overweight, while I'm sure at some point in the theoretical future, there will be a time when people who are perhaps not the most fit people in the world will be able to go to space, will maybe even be able to go to Mars. I very much doubt that that's going to be in the early phases. So I've been working on my kettlebells. That's what I've been doing. And I've been doing this because I got inspired by you. So I thought maybe you could quickly tell our viewers about how exactly you got into kettlebells and why, and the results that you've been getting from that.
Well, it all started about 2 years ago. I looked at what were not at the time my before pictures. They are my before pictures now, and they will never see the light of day because I'm making a weird face in them and also standing around in my tidy whities. But anyways, around that time, I was reading The 4-Hour Body by Tim Ferriss, and he introduced me to the idea of the two-handed kettlebell swing, and so I started with a 3 times a week workout, which featured two-handed kettlebell swings as part of a rotation of several exercises. Initially, I was doing these at a gym. Remember, this was 2 years ago. But nowadays, I've put together a device described in Tim Ferriss's book, which I believe he referred to as a Hungarian core blaster, but which I call 6 pieces of steel plumbing pipe, some hockey tape, and a bunch of weights. So I'm now swinging a 45-pound kettlebell for 6 sets of 50 swings. That comes out to 300 kettlebell swings in a given workout. And that's my Monday and Friday workout. I do different stuff on Wednesdays, and then Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, I go for runs, because even though the running is actually a fairly recent addition, because, I realized that, hey, I have more energy and different body parts that don't get this kind of a workout. So I needed to work on those, and also my endurance. Because for all their intensity, my workouts don't normally last longer than 45 minutes at the outside. So how's your workouts going, James?
They've been going okay. First of all, I just want to ask you, do you feel any, like, how does your strength feel from now compared to the beginning? Have you noticed like a noticeable increase in your sort of general physical preparedness, your ability to do work? Or have you noticed like hypertrophy gains or anything like that?
There have been some definite gains in hypertrophy. The
that's muscle gain.
The thing to bear in mind is that at the same time I started doing these 3 times a week workout schedule, I also switched over my diet to the one described in that same book by Tim Ferriss, which he referred to as the slow carb diet, as opposed to low carb diet or outright ketosis. So I've been on and off that semi-consistently for the past 2 years now. And initially I dropped about 20 pounds of body fat, and in the time since then I haven't as rigorously measuring, but I have put on another 20 pounds, presumably mostly of muscle. And the thing about having a sense of my own preparedness is that I work at a desk, James. I don't go out and lift heavy things regularly as part of my work. So while I have been I have been physically feeling better in the sense that I don't feel exhausted as much, and I don't feel strained as much, and I've even found that some chronic pain that I had gotten to the point of almost just bearing with and ignoring has all but vanished. So
I would say this sounds pretty positive, quite frankly.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call this
I'd say it's overwhelmingly positive. I'm just having a hard
time. Yeah. That's fair enough.
I've found it difficult to quantify the gains, even though I was measuring stuff fairly regularly. I know from my caliper readings that I... during the initial recomposition, I dropped from being technically overweight and having an abnormally high body fat percentage for my height and weight to being at the low end of normal for body fat percentage.
Very nice. So you, so okay, so
yeah.
So here's what I've been doing. I am not nearly as advanced as you are. I'm going to start out by saying that. I currently have 3 kettlebells. No, correction, I have 4 kettlebells, but that's the story. This morning I had 3 kettlebells. I had an 8, a 12, and a 16. And I have been swinging the 16, and I've been doing sets of 20. And I haven't really felt that challenged by these for quite a while. But I've been integrating them with kettlebell ribbons and kettlebell presses. So for those of you who don't know, a kettlebell ribbon is you take the kettlebell, it starts on one side of your by your thigh in both hands, and then you lift it up diagonally across your chest, up to your ear, behind your head, around your head, back to the other ear, and then down diagonally the other way across your chest to your opposite thigh. That's one ribbon. And then you do it, and then you go opposite the other way. And it's kind of weird because I haven't found a lot of... Sorry?
I said, okay then, I'm going to have to look these up.
Yeah, I've found a little bit of documentation on these. A lot of people online talk about using them for shoulder health and for general toning, which is a bit of a weird phrase because this is not a phrase that I usually associate with the kind of people who are discussing kettlebell training, but they say general toning. I have found that the kettlebell ribbons are an incredible workout because when I do them, I can feel that every muscle in my upper body is being utilized in this particular movement. So like my forearms, my biceps, my triceps, shoulder muscles, a little bit of chest, and a lot of back. Activating the core as well, keeping the core straight with isometric contractions, and even my legs for isometric contractions as well. And after doing a whole bunch of kettlebell ribbons, I feel like I've worked up everything in my upper body. And I'm not entirely sure why, when I look up online, there isn't as much attention being given to kettlebell ribbons as to a lot of other kettlebell stuff. So my current protocol is kettlebell swings followed by kettlebell ribbons, and then kettlebell swings and kettlebell ribbons and kettlebell swings and kettlebell ribbons. When I have finished building out the loft bed and the mezzanine in my apartment, I will also install the rings and start doing some gymnastics works as well. But that's later on.
But
as I said, my kettlebell ribbons, which I'm currently doing with a 12 kilo, that's pretty much bang on where I should be. I'm currently doing 24 kettlebell ribbons, 12 on each side. And that feels like exactly on the sweet spot. When I get to the end, my muscles are starting to, they're starting to feel like I'm actually doing real work. And I can feel it all over my upper body. So that feels like bang on. And when I move down to 16 kilos when I move up to 16 kilos and drop the volume, I feel that that will be a very good progression for the ribbons. And I've noticed an increase in hypertrophy and strength and sort of a general feeling that I am fitter and that my physique is improving in my upper body and my lower body because of the swings. But I've only got a 16 kilo kettlebell and the swings are feeling pretty anemic. I just don't feel like I'm being stressed that much by the swings. You're doing a high volume kettlebell routine. I'm planning not to do the same thing. I'm planning to go to like 25 swings, which is what I'm doing at the moment, 25 swings per set. And then drop down to a higher weight. And that's what and this morning I decided I needed a higher weight. So that's actually what I did this afternoon. I went out on my bike, cycled up a massive hill because this is Cyprus. And so the beach is over there and the mountains are right over there. And in between, there are lots of hills and I live on the side of it. So that's another way that you can get a lot of leg exercises, or at least I do. But it's a 22 kilo kettlebell. They didn't have a 20 kilo kettlebell in the store when I went there. So it was pretty dicey. I had to manhandle this 22 kilo kettlebell into the bag that is attached to the back of my bike. You know those saddle bags that you can get that you put on the end of the back of your bike?
Yes.
Putting a 22 kilo kettlebell on one side of a saddlebag on a bicycle is it's a pretty hairy experience. I walked most of the way down the first half of the trail back to my house, and I did get on and I did cycle a bit of the way there because it was about a 1 hour walk otherwise in like 32 degree heat with the sun bearing down on you and all kind of stuff, quite unpleasant. But I did manage it. I have it at home, and so I am now going to attempt to move up the scale to a 22 kilo kettlebell, which I believe actually is probably what you're working with right about now when you said that you were working with a 48 pound, I think you said, 50 pound?
45.
Yeah, if you divide that by 2.2, what do you get? 45 divided by 2.2. Yeah, 20 kilos.
45 pounds is not quite 20 and a half kilograms.
Yeah. So you've currently got a 20 and a half kilo kettlebell and you are doing sets of 50 for that. I'm going up to 22 kilograms. So I'm going to be a little bit heavier than you, but I certainly am not going to be doing sets of 50. I'm probably going to drop it down to sets of 8 to 10. To begin with, given the fact that it is a very large jump for me, because that's the methodology that Mr. Pavel Tetsulin suggests. But at the same time, the 16 kilo kettlebell swings feel a little bit anemic for me. So maybe I will be able to increase the volume a lot reasonably quickly. Who knows? I will keep you updated. So that's my T-minus unknown, my current preparation. How about you? What are you doing?
As we may eventually get back to discussing in one of our other podcasts, you and I have also been thinking about cultivating a spirit of adventure in ourselves. And
Yes.
My project to get a sailboat back up to working order has amply demonstrated to me the idea that boat stands for bring out another thousand, because it turned out that repairing this thing is a real chore. So I don't know if I'm actually going to get the boat in the water this year, but I have found an alternative adventure for myself to go on. And in this particular case, it has to do with a bit of the local history for Vancouver Island. So people who haven't been to BC might be aware that the largest city in the province is Vancouver, but Vancouver is not the capital of British Columbia. That's Victoria, which is here on Vancouver Island. And at least part of the reason for that has to do with accessibility, I think. And the fact that Vancouver Island, being an island, has quite a few more ports that you can reach just as easily as you can reach any of the inland places on the island. And one of the ports that still exists to this day is the town of Crofton, which I live in Mill Bay, and Crofton is, I'd say, about the size of Mill Bay, maybe a little bit bigger, because it's currently the home of the Crofton Pulp Mill, which is probably one of the biggest industrial sites that still exists on the island. However, the pulp mill was not the original industry of the Crofton area. The original industry of the Crofton area, back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, was Mr. Henry Croft's copper smelter. There was a fairly prominent copper mine industry in Mount Sicker, which is not one of the better known mountains of the Cowichan district, but it is better known as far as listing all of the mountains, but of the ones that people are aware of, if you're standing in the middle of Cowichan and look around, you're not going to see Mount Sicker, because it's behind Mount Prevost, which is well known for having two summits. Anyways, I'm getting off track here. Mount Sicker,
you are.
Copper mining, back in the back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, the copper mines of Mount Sicker produced about 9,000 tons of copper from the that were all smelted at the Crofton smelter. There was a small railway, narrow gauge railway, that was actually regarded as one of the most dangerous railways in the area, just because of the steep descent that it had to go down to get the copper from the mines to the smelter. And in fact, rather than build a second smelter on the mainland to handle copper mines that were producing in the Vancouver area, or the region that is now the Greater Vancouver area, they just shipped the copper ore from there over to the island for smelting. So we've had a real reversal in the prominence of our various settlements since the completion of the railway that went across Canada. Anyhow, the mines in Mount Sicker were all more or less shut down after the... well, basically what it turns out was that the copper was mostly exported from Vancouver Island. It wasn't used locally. And as an export business, it was fine up until less expensive sources of copper became available closer to where they were being used. And so the whole business shut down. The smelter actually burned down. And that was the end of copper mining on Vancouver Island. But the trails up to the copper mines still exist on Mount Sicker. So, in conjunction with some friends from the local area here, I have put together a plan to hike up to the Lenora mine on, well, the site of the former Lenora mine on Mount Sicker. And that is what I'm going to be doing tomorrow. I'm going to wake up really early. We are going to go hunt rabbits for a while first. And after that, we will be hiking to an abandoned copper mine.
Very cool. What are you expecting to find when you get there? I mean, what are you planning to do?
Well, I'm expecting to find a great big hole in the ground. And I do mean that in terms of size, because I mentioned in my story there that over the course of their lifetimes, the mines and Crofton Smelter produced some 9,000 tons of copper metal. But if you look at the yield of copper metal from copper ore, you find it's barely more than half a percent, or yeah, barely more than half a percent per unit of mass, which means that if we got 9,000 tons of metal, 9,000 tons, I did this calculation yesterday, but forgot to write it down, but 9,000 tons, which we know came out of 0.6%, means that we're looking at about 1.5 million tons of ore were taken out of Mount Sicker. Now, I don't know about you, James, but to me, 1.5 million tons of rock sounds like it must have left a bloody big hole in the ground. Especially if it got to the point that they were operating a gauge railroad up the side of a mountain to bring it down in job lots. And especially considering that the operation was large enough to support a small town that was halfway up a mountain. So, the town doesn't exist, but did find YouTube videos of folks exploring the abandoned mineshaft, and I don't intend to go too far into it myself, but one of my party members for this trip is a geologist, so I'm hoping that I can learn something about the current state of the local rock. And I'm interested in that because, as I mentioned, the reason for the smelter and the mines shut down was not because they ran out of ore in these deposits. It was basically solely because more economical sources of copper became available closer to the locations where copper was being consumed. So there probably is still a fair bit of usable ore up there, and it was something that intrigued me to look into, because up until I found out about the copper mines of Mount Sicker within the past week, actually, I had thought that most of the mining on Vancouver Island was for coal. I know that... We actually had, what was it now? biker gangs up in Nanaimo using the disused coal mine tunnels under the city for drug smuggling operations. And I seem to recall that Duncan, the nearest city to Mill Bay, was another coal mining community. And that, in fact, John A. McDonald, who's recently had some statues pulled down back east, the first Prime Minister of Canada, traveled through Duncan, and Duncan only got the railroad station it did because of a popular outturning for the passage of Sir John A. McDonald's train through the village.
Okay.
But
sounds like
that's
an adventure.
Quite enough of a tangent about the industrial history of Vancouver Island.
Yeah.
All of this was to say, I'm going for a hike.
Good. Okay. Well, cultivating the spirit of adventure so that when the time comes and, you know, someone says, would you like to go to Mars? The reaction won't be, I don't know. Rather it'll be, yeah, let's do that, you know, kind of thing. So, yeah, going to see an abandoned copper mine sounds like a good idea. Wish I could come with you.
Yep, okay. I will
so
have
we wrap
to
this up?
Make do with. Yes, let's wrap this up.
Okay, right. Okay, so, and on that note, that copper mine adventure note, it's goodbye from me, James Coombs.
And it's goodbye from me, Soren Childs.
And remember, prepare now, because the future is sooner than you think. The journey continues. Thank you for listening. Thank you to everyone who supports us. Be sure to subscribe and review. We really appreciate it. And if you're ready to go one step further, head on over to marsreadynow.com to read and commit to the Mars Ready Now manifesto. To win in space first requires you to win on Earth. Again, that's marsreadynow.com, link in the description.